on the end. Let me hazard a wild stab. One is for Rob Stark, the others for Lord Stannis and Renly. Would that be right?
Yes, my lord.
My nephew is 13 years old today, Villar. Try and recall that. I'll have the heads down on the morrow, or one of those empty spikes may have a different lodger. Do you take my meaning, Captain?
I'll see that they're taken down myself, my lord.
Good.
Tyrion put his heels into his horse and trotted away, leaving the red cloaks to follow as best they could. He had told Cersei he intended to take the measure of the city. That was not entirely a lie. Tyrion Lannister was not pleased by much of what he saw. The streets of King's Landing had always been teeming and raucous and noisy, but now they reeked of danger in a way that he did not recall from past visits. A naked corpse sprawled in the gutter near the Street of Looms, being torn at by a pack of feral dogs. Yet no one seemed to care. Watchmen were much in evidence, moving in pairs through the alleys in their gold cloaks and shirts of black ringmail, iron cudgels never far from their hands. The markets were crowded with ragged men selling their household goods for any price they could get, and conspicuously empty of farmers selling food. What little produce he did see was three times as costly as it had been a year ago. One peddler was hawking rats, roasted on a skewer.
"Fresh rats!" he cried loudly. "Fresh rats!"
Doubtless fresh rats were to be preferred to old, stale, rotten rats. The frightening thing was, the rats looked more appetizing than most of what the butchers were selling. On the Street of Flour, Tyrion saw guards at every other shop door. When times grew lean, even bakers found sellswords cheaper than bread, he reflected.
There is no food coming in, is there? He said to Valar.
Little enough, the captain admitted. With the war in the Riverlands and Lord Renly raising rebels in Highgarden, the roads are closed to south and west.
And what has my good sister done about this?
She is taking steps to restore the king's peace, Villar assured him. Lord Slint has triple the size of the city watch, and the queen has put 1,000 craftsmen to work on our defences. The stonemasons are strengthening the walls, carpenters are building scorpions and catapults by the hundred, fletchers are making arrows, the smiths are forging blades, and the alchemist guild has pledged 10,000 jars of wildfire.
Tyrion shifted uncomfortably in his saddle. He was pleased that Cersei had not been idle, but wildfire was treacherous stuff, and 10,000 jars were enough to turn all of King's Landing into cinders.
Where has my sister found the coin to pay for all this?
It was no secret that King Robert had left the crown vastly in debt, and alchemists were seldom mistaken for altruists.
Lord Littlefinger always finds a way, my lord. He has imposed a tax on those wishing to enter the city.
Yes, that would work, Tyrion said, thinking, clever, clever and cruel.
Tens of thousands had fled the fighting for the supposed safety of King's Landing. He had seen them on the King's Road, troops of mothers and children, and anxious fathers, who had gazed on his horses and wagons with covetous eyes. Once they reached the city, they would doubtless pay over all they had to put those high, comforting walls between them and the war, though they might think twice if they knew about the wildfire. The inn, beneath the sign of the broken anvil, stood within sight of those walls, near the gate of the guards where they had entered that morning. As they rode into its courtyard, a boy ran out to help Tyrion down from his horse.
"Take your men back to the castle," he told Valar. "I'll be spending the night here."
The captain looked dubious.
"Will you be safe, my lord?"
"Well, as to that, captain, when I left the inn this morning, it was full of black ears. One is never quite safe when Chella, daughter of Cheek, is about."
Tyrion waddled towards the door, leaving Valar to puzzle at his meaning. A gust of merriment greeted him as he shoved into the inn's common room. He recognized Cella's throaty chuckle and the lighter music of Shay's laughter. The girl was seated by the hearth, sipping wine at her round wooden table with three of the black ears he'd left to guard her, and a plump man whose back was to him. The innkeeper, he assumed, until Shay called Tyrion by name and the intruder rose.
"My good lord, I'm so pleased to see you," he gushed, a soft eunuch smile on his powdered face.
Tyrion stumbled.
"Lord Varys, I had not thought to see you here."
The others take him. How did he find them so quickly?
"Forgive me if I intrude," Varys said. "I was taken by a sudden urge to meet your young lady."
"Young lady," Shay repeated, savouring the words. "You're half right, my lord. I'm young." 18, Tyrion thought. 18 and a whore. But quick of wit, nimble as a cat between the sheets, with large dark eyes and fine black hair, and a sweet, soft, hungry little mouth. And mine. Damn you, eunuch.
"I fear I'm the intruder, Lord Varys," he said with forced courtesy. "When I came in, you were in the midst of some merriment."
"My Lord Varys complimented Cella on her ears and said she must have killed many men to have such a fine necklace," Shay explained.
It grated on him to hear her call Varys, "my lord," in that tone. That was what she called him in their pillow play.
"And Cella told him only cowards kill the vanquished."
"Braver to leave the man alive, with a chance to cleanse his shame by winning back his ear,"
explained Cella, a small dark woman whose grisly neckwear was hung with no less than 46 dried, wrinkled ears. Tyrion had counted them once.
"Only so you can prove you do not fear your enemies."
Shay hooted.
"And then my lord says that if he was a black ear, he'd never sleep for dreams of one-eared men."
"A problem. I will never need face," Tyrion said. "I'm terrified of my enemies, so I kill them all."
Varys giggled.
"Will you take some wine with us, my lord?"
"I'll take some wine."
Tyrion seated himself beside Shay. He understood what was happening here, if Cella and the girl did not. Varys was delivering a message. When he said,
"I was taken by a sudden urge to meet your young lady,"
what he meant was,
"you tried to hide her, but I knew where she was and who she was, and here I am."
He wondered who had betrayed him. The innkeeper, that boy in the stable, a guard on the gate, or one of his own?
"I always like to return to the city through the gates of the guards," Varys told Shay as he filled the wine cups. "The carvings on the gatehouse are exquisite. They make me weep each time I see them. The eyes, so expressive, don't you think? They almost seem to follow you as you ride beneath the portcullis."
"I never noticed, my lord," Shay replied. "I'll look again on the morrow if it please you."
"Don't bother, sweetling," Tyrion thought, swirling the wine in the cup.
"He cares not a whit about carvings. The eyes he boasts of are his own. What he means is that he was watching, that he knew we were here the moment we passed through the gates."
"Do be careful, child," Varys urged. "King's Landing is not wholly safe these days. I know these streets well, and yet I almost feared to come today, alone and unarmed as I was. Lawless men are everywhere in this dark time. Oh, yes, men with cold steel and colder hearts. Where I can come alone and unarmed, others can come with swords in their fists," he was saying.
Shay only laughed. "If they try and bother me, they'll be one ear short when Cella runs them off."
Varys hooted as if that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. But there was no laughter in his eyes when he turned them on Tyrion.
"Your young lady has an amiable way to her. I should take very good care of her if I were you.
I intend to. Any man who tries to arm her, well, I'm too small to be a black ear, and I make no claims to courage. See, I speak the same tongue as you, eunuch. Hurt her, and I'll have your head.
I will leave you, Varys rose. I know how weary you must be. I only wish to welcome you, my lord, and tell you how very pleased I am by your arrival. We have dire need of you on the council. Have you seen the comet?
I'm short, not blind, Tyrion said.
Out on the King's Road, it seemed to cover half the sky, outshining the crescent moon.
In the streets, they call it the Red Messenger, Varys said. They say it comes as a herald before a king to warn of fire and blood to follow.
The eunuch rubbed his powdered hands together.
May I leave you with a bit of a riddle, Lord Tyrion?
He did not wait for an answer.
In a room sit three great men, a king, a priest, and a rich man with his gold. Between them stands a sellsword. A little man of common birth and no great mind. Each of the great ones bids him slay the other two. Do it, says the king, for I am your lawful ruler. Do it, said the priest, for I command you in the name of the gods. Do it, said the rich man, and all this gold shall be yours. So tell me, who lives and who dies?
Bowing deeply, the eunuch hurried from the common room on soft, slippered feet. When he was gone, Chella gave a snort, and Shay wrinkled up her pretty face.
The rich man lives, doesn't he?
Tyrion sipped his wine, thoughtful.
Perhaps, or not. That would depend on the sellsword, it seems.
He set down his cup.
Come, let's go upstairs.
She had to wait for him at the top of the steps, for her legs were slim and supple, while his were short and stunted and full of aches. But she was smiling when he reached her.
"Did you miss me?" she teased, as she took his hand.
"Desperately," Tyrion admitted. Shay only stood a shade above 5 feet, yet still he must look up to her. But in her case, he found he did not mind. She was sweet to look up at.
"You'll miss me all the time in your red keep," she said, as she led him to her room. "All alone, in your cold bed, in your tower of the hand."
Too true. Tyrion would gladly have kept her with him, but his lord father had forbidden it. You will not take the whore to court, Lord Tywin had commanded. Bringing her to the city was as much defiance as he dared. All his authority derived from his father. The girl had to understand that.
You won't be far, he promised. You'll have a house, with guards and servants, and I'll visit as often as I am able.
Shay kicked shut the door. Through the cloudy panes of the narrow window, he could make out the great sept of Baelor crowning Visenya's hill. But Tyrion was distracted by a different sight. Bending, Shay took her gown by the hem, drew it over her head, and tossed it aside. She did not believe in small clothes.
You'll never be able to rest, she said,
as she stood before him, pink and nude and lovely, one hand braced on her hip.
You'll think of me every time you go to bed. Then you'll get hard, and you'll have no one to help you, and you'll never be able to sleep unless you...
She grinned, that wicked grin Tyrion liked so well.
Is that why they call it the Tower of the Hand, my lord?
Be quiet and kiss me, he commanded. He could taste the wine on her lips and feel her small, firm breasts pressed against him as her fingers moved to the lacings of his breeches.
My lion,
she whispered when he broke off the kiss to undress.
"My sweet lord, my giant of Lannister."
Tyrion pushed her toward the bed. When he entered her, she screamed loud enough to wake Baelor the Blessed in his tomb, and her nails left gouges in his back. He never had a pain he liked half so well. "Fool," he thought to himself afterward, as they lay in the centre of the sagging mattress amidst the rumpled sheets. "Will you never learn, dwarf? She's a whore, damn you. It's your coin she loves, not your cuck. Remember Taisha?" Yet when his fingers trailed lightly over one nipple, it stiffened at the touch, and he could see the mark on her breast where he'd bitten her in his passion.
"So what will you do, my lord, now that you're the hand of the king?"
Shay asked him, as he cupped that warm, sweet flesh.
"Something Cersei will never expect," Tyrion murmured softly against her slender neck. "I'll do justice."
Bran preferred the hard stone of the window seat to the comforts of his feather bed and blankets. A bed, the walls pressed close and the ceiling hung heavy above him. A bed, the room was his cell and Winterfell his prison. Yet outside his window, the wide world still called. He could not walk, nor climb, nor hunt, nor fight with a wooden sword as once he had, but he could still look. He liked to watch the windows begin to glow all over Winterfell, as candles and hearth fires were lit behind the diamond-shaped panes of tower and hall, and he loved to listen to the direwolf sing to the stars. Of late, he often dreamed of wolves.
"They are talking to me, brother to brother,"
he told himself when the direwolves howled.
He could almost understand them. Not quite, not truly, but almost, as if they were singing in a language he had once known and somehow forgotten.
The Walders might be scared of them, but the Starks had wolf blood. Old Nan told him so.
"They'll be stronger in some than in others," she warned.
Summer's howls were long and sad, full of grief and longing. Shaggy dogs were more savage. Their voices echoed through the yards and halls until the castle rang, and it seemed as though some great pack of direwolves haunted Winterfell, instead of only two. Two where there had once been six. "Do they miss their brothers and sisters too?" Bran wondered. "Are they calling to Grey Wind and Ghost, to Nymeria and Lady Shade? Do they want them to come home and be a pack together?" "Who can know the mind of a wolf?" Sir Roderick Cassell said when Bran asked him why they howled. Bran's lady mother had named him Castellan of Winterfell in her absence, and his duties left him little time for idle questions.
"It's freedom they're calling for," declared Farlan, who was kennel-master and had no more love for the direwolves than his hounds did. "They don't like being walled up, and who's to blame them? Wild things belong in the wild, not in a castle."
"They want to hunt," agreed Gage the cook, as he tossed cubes of suet into a great kettle of stew. "A wolf smells better than any man. Like as not, they've caught the scent of prey."
Maester Lewin did not think so.
"Wolves often howl at the moon. These are howling at the comet. See how bright it is, Bran. Perchance they think it is the moon."
When Bran repeated that to Usher, she laughed aloud.
"Your wolves have more wit than your maester," the Wildland woman said. "They know truths the Grey Man has forgotten."
The way she said it made him shiver. And when he asked what the comet meant, she said,
"Blood and fire, boy, and nothing sweet."
Bran asked Septon Shale about the comet when they were sorting through some scrolls snatched from the library fire.
"It's a sword that slays the season," he replied.
And soon after, the White Raven came from Old Town bringing word of autumn, so doubtless he was right. Though old Nan did not think so. She'd live longer than any of them.
Dragons,
she said, lifting her head and sniffing. She was near blind and could not see the comet, yet she claimed she could smell it.
It be dragons, boy,
she insisted. Bran got no princes from Nan, no more than he ever had. Hodor said only, Hodor. That was all he ever said. And still the direwolves howled. The guards on the walls muttered curses. Hounds in the kennels barked furiously. Horses kicked at their stalls. The Walders shivered by their fire. And even Maester Lewin complained of sleepless nights. Only Bran did not mind. Sir Roderick had confined the wolves to the guardswood after Shaggy Dog bit Little Walder. But the stones of Winterfell played queer tricks with sound, and sometimes it sounded as if they were in the yard right below Bran's window. Other times he would have sworn they were up on the curtain walls, loping around like sentries. He wished that he could see them. He could see the comet hanging above the guards' hall and the bell tower, and farther back the first keep squat and round, its gargoyles' black shapes against the bruised purple dusk. Once Bran had known every stone of those buildings, inside and out. He'd climbed them all, scampering up walls as easily as other boys ran downstairs. The rooftops had been his secret places, and the crows atop the broken tower his special friends. And then he had fallen. Bran did not remember falling, yet they said he had, so he supposed it must be true. He'd almost died. When he saw the weather-worn gargoyles atop the first keep, where it had happened, he got a queer, tight feeling in his belly. And now he could not climb, nor walk, nor run, nor sword fight. And the dreams he'd dreamed of knighthood had soured in his head. Summer had howled the day Bran had fallen, and for long after as he lay broken in his bed. Rob had told him so before he went away to war. Summer had mourned for him, and Shaggy Dog and Grey Wind had joined in his grief. And the night the Bloody Raven had brought word of their father's death, the wolves had known that too. Bran had been in the Maester's turret with Rickon, talking of the children of the forest, when Summer and Shaggy Dog had drowned out Lewin with their howls. Who are they mourning now? Had some enemy slain the king in the north, who used to be his brother, Rob? Had his bastard brother, Jon Snow, fallen from the wall? Had his mother died, or one of his sisters? Or was this something else, as Maester and Septon and old Nan seemed to think? If I were truly a direwolf, I would understand the song, he thought wistfully. In his wolf dreams, he could race up the side of mountains, jagged, icy mountains, taller than any tower, and stand at the summit beneath the full moon with all the world below him the way it used to be. Ow! Bran cried tentatively. He cupped his hands around his mouth and lifted his head to the comet. Ow! Ow! He howled. It sounded stupid, high and hollow and quavering, a little boy's howl, not a wolf's. Yet Summer gave answer, his deep voice drowning out Bran's thin one, and Shaggy Dog made it a chorus. Bran hurrooed again. They howled together, last of their pack. The noise brought a guard to his door, Hayhead, with a wen on his nose. He appeared in, saw Bran howling out of the window and said, "What's this, my prince?" It made Bran feel queer when they called him prince. Although he was Rob's heir and Rob was king in the north now, he turned his head to howl at the guard. "Oh! Oh!" Hayhead screwed up his face. "Now you stop that there. Oh! Oh!" The guardsman retreated. When he came back, Maester Lewin was with him, all in grey, his chain tight about his neck.
"Bran, those beasts make sufficient noise without your help."
He crossed the room and put his hand on the boy's brow.
"The hour grows late. You ought to be fast asleep."
"I'm talking to the wolves." Bran brushed the hand aside.
"Shall I have Hayhead carry you to your bed?"
"I can get to bed myself." Mickon had hammered a row of iron bars into the wall so Bran could pull himself about the room with his arms. It was slow and hard, and it made his shoulders ache, but he hated being carried. "Anyway, I don't have to sleep if I don't want to."
"All men must sleep, Bran, even princes." "When I sleep, I turn into a wolf."
Bran turned his face away and looked back out into the night.
"Do wolves dream?" "All creatures dream, I think, yet not as men do."
"Do dead men dream?" Bran asked, thinking of his father. In the dark crypts below Winterfell, a stonemason was chiselling out his father's likeness in granite.
"Some say yes, some no," the maester answered. "The dead themselves are silent on the matter." "Do trees dream?"
"Trees, no."
"They do," Bran said with sudden certainty. "They dream tree dreams. I dream of a tree sometimes, a weirwood, like the one in the God's Wood. It calls to me. The wolf dreams are better. I smell things, and sometimes I can taste the blood."
Maester Lewin tugged at his chain where it chafed his neck.
"If you would only spend more time with the other children." "I hate the other children," Bran said, meaning the Walders. "I commanded you to send them away."
Lewin grew stern.
"The Freys are your lady mother's wards, sent here to be fostered at her express command. It is not for you to expel them, nor is it kind. If we turn them out, where would they go?" "Home. It's therefore you won't let me have summer." "The Frey boy did not ask to be attacked," the maester said, "no more than I did." "That was Shaggy Dog."
Rickon's big black wolf was so wild he even frightened Bran at times.
"Summer never bit anyone." "Summer ripped out a man's throat in this very chamber, or have you forgotten? The truth is, those sweet pups you and your brothers found in the snow have grown into dangerous beasts. The Frey boys are wise to be wary of them."
"We should put the Walders in the God's Wood. They could play Lord of the Crossing all they want, and Summer could sleep with me again. If I'm the prince, why won't you heed me? I wanted to ride Dancer, but Alebelly wouldn't let me pass the gate."
"And rightly so. The Wolf's Wood is full of danger. Your last ride should have taught you that. Would you want some outlaw to take you captive and sell you to the Lannisters?"
"Summer would save me,"
Bran insisted stubbornly.
"Princes should be allowed to sail the sea and hunt boar in the Wolf's Wood and joust with lances."
"Bran, child, why do you torment yourself so? One day you may do some of these things, but now you're only a boy of 8.
I'd sooner be a wolf than I could live in the wood and sleep when I wanted. And I could find Arya and Sansa. I'd smell where they were and go save them. And when Rob went to battle, I'd fight beside him like Grey Wind. I'd tear out the Kingslayer's throat with my teeth. Rip! And then the war would be over and everyone would come back to Winterfell. If I was a wolf," he howled, "Oh!"
Lewin raised his voice.
"A true prince would welcome, oh!"
Bran howled louder.
"Oh!"
The maester surrendered.
"As you will, child."
With a look that was part grief and part disgust, he left the bedchamber. Howling lost its savour once Bran was alone. After a time he quieted.
"I did welcome them," he told himself, resentful. "I was the lord in Winterfell, a true lord. You can't say I wasn't."
When the Walders arrived from the towers, it had been Rickon who wanted them gone. A baby of 4, he had screamed that he wanted mother and father and Rob, not these strangers. It had been up to Bran to soothe him and bid the Freys welcome. He had offered them meat and mead and a seat by the fire, and even Maester Luin had said afterward that he had done well. Only that was before the game. The game was played with a log, a staff, a body of water, and a great deal of shouting. The water was the most important, Walder and Walder assured Bran. You could use a plank or even a series of stones, and a branch could be your staff. You didn't have to shout, but without water there was no game. As Maester Luin and Sir Roderick were not about to let the children go wandering off into the Wolf's Wood in search of a stream, they made do with one of the murky pools in the Godswood. Walder and Walder had never seen hot water bubbling from the ground before, but they both allowed how it would make the game even better. Both of them were called Walder Frey. Big Walder said there were bunches of Walders at the Twins, all named after the boy's grandfather, Lord Walder Frey.
"We have our own names at Winterfell," Rickon told them haughtily when he heard that.
The way their game was played, you laid a log across the water, and one player stood in the middle with a stick. He was the Lord of the Crossing, and when one of the other players came up, he had to say, "I am the Lord of the Crossing, who goes there?" And the other player had to make up a speech about who they were and why they should be allowed to cross. The Lord could make them swear oaths and answer questions. They didn't have to tell the truth, but the oaths were binding unless they said mayhaps, so the trick was to say mayhaps so the Lord of the Crossing didn't notice. Then you could try and knock the Lord into the water, and you got to be Lord of the Crossing, but only if you'd said mayhaps. Otherwise, you were out of the game. The Lord got to knock anyone in the water any time he pleased, and he was the only one who got to use a stick. In practice, the game seemed to come down to mostly shoving, hitting, and falling into the water, along with a lot of loud arguments about whether or not someone had said mayhaps. Little Walder was Lord of the Crossing more often than not. He was Little Walder, even though he was tall and stout, with a red face and a big round belly. Big Walder was sharp-faced and skinny and half a foot shorter.
"He's 52 days older than me," Little Walder explained. "So he was bigger at first, but I grew faster."
"We're cousins, not brothers," answered Big Walder, the little one. "I'm Walder, son of Jamis. My father was Lord Walder's son by his fourth wife. He's Walder's son of merit. His grandmother was Lord Walder's third wife, the Craycor. He's ahead of me in the line of succession, even though I'm older."
"Only by 52 days, Little Walder objected. "And neither of us will ever hold the Twins, stupid."
"I will," Big Walder declared. "And we're not the only Walders either. Sir Stevron has a grandson, Black Walder. He's fourth in line of succession. And there's Red Walder, Sir Eamon's son, and Bastard Walder, who isn't in the line at all. He's called Walder Rivers, not Walder Frey. Plus there's girls named Walder."
"And Tyre? You always forget Tyre."
"He's Waltyre, not Walder," Big Walder said airily. "And he's after us, so it doesn't matter. Anyhow, I never liked him."
Sir Roderick decreed that they would share Jon Snow's old bedchamber, since Jon was in the Night's Watch and never coming back. Bran hated that. It made him feel as if the Freys were trying to steal Jon's place. He had watched wistfully while the Walders contested with Turnip the cook's boy and Joseph's girls Bandy and Shira. The Walders had decreed that Bran should be the judge and decide whether or not people had said mayhaps, but as soon as they started playing, they forgot all about him. The shouts and splashes soon drew others. Pala, the kennel girl. Kane's boy, Kaelin. Tom, too, whose father, Fat Tom, had died with Bran's father at King's Landing. Before very long, every one of them was soaked and muddy. Pala was brown from head to heel, with moss in her hair, breathless from laughter. Bran had not heard so much laughing since the night the bloody raven came. "If I had my legs, I'd knock them all into the water," he thought bitterly. "No one would ever be Lord of the Crossing but me." Finally, Rickon came running into the Godswood, Shaggy Dog at his heels. He watched Turnip and Little Walder struggle for the stick until Turnip lost his footing and went in with a huge splash, arms waving. Rickon yelled,
"Me! Me now! I want to play!"
Little Walder beckoned him on, and Shaggy Dog started to follow.
"No, Shaggy!" his brother commanded. "Wolves can't play. You stay with Bran."
And he did. Until Little Walder had smacked Rickon with a stick square across his belly. Before Bran could blink, the black wolf was flying over the plank. There was blood in the water. The Walders were shrieking red murder. Rickon sat in the mud laughing, and Hoda came lumbering in, shouting, "Hoda! Hoda! Hoda!" After that, oddly, Rickon decided he liked the Walders. They never played Lord of the Crossing again, but they played other games. Monsters and maidens, rats and cats, come into my castle, all sorts of things. With Rickon by their side, the Walders plundered the kitchen for pies and honeycombs, raced round the walls, tossed bones to the pups in the kennels, and trained with wooden swords under Sir Roderick's sharp eye. Rickon even showed them the deep vaults under the earth, where the stonemason was carving Father's tomb.
"You had no right," Bran screamed at his brother when he heard. "That was our place, a Stark place."
But Rickon never cared. The door to his bedchamber opened. Maester Lewin was carrying a green jar, and this time Usher and Hayhead came with him.
"I've made you a sleeping draught, Bran."
Usher scooped him up in her bony arms. She was very tall for a woman, and wiry strong. She bore him effortlessly to his bed.
"This will give you dreamless sleep," Maester Lewin said as he pulled the stopper from the jar. "Sweet dreamless sleep."
"It will," Bran said, wanting to believe.
"Yes, drink."
Bran drank. The potion was thick and chalky, but there was honey in it, so it went down easy.
"Come the morn, you'll feel better."
Lewin gave Bran a smile and a pat as he took his leave. Usher lingered behind.
"Is it the wolf dreams again?"
Bran nodded.
"You should not fight so hard, boy. I see you talking to the heart tree. Maybe the gods are trying to talk back."
"The gods?" he murmured, drowsy already. Usher's face grew blurry and grey. "Sweet, dreamless sleep," Bran thought. Yet when the darkness closed over him, he found himself in the Godswood, moving silently beneath green-grey sentinels and gnarled oaks as old as time. "I am walking," he thought, exulting. Part of him knew that it was only a dream. But even the dream of walking was better than the truth of his bedchamber, walls, and ceiling and door. It was dark amongst the trees, but the comet lit his way, and his feet were sure. He was moving on four good legs, strong and swift, and he could feel the ground underfoot, the soft crackling of fallen leaves, thick roots and hard stones, the deep layers of humus. It was a good feeling. The smells filled his head, alive and intoxicating. The green muddy stink of the hot pools, the perfume of rich, rotting earth beneath his paws, the squirrels in the oaks. The scent of squirrel made him remember the taste of hot blood and the way the bones would crack beneath his teeth. Slaver filled his mouth. He had eaten no more than half a day past, yet there was no joy in dead meat, even deer. He could hear the squirrels chittering and rustling above him, safe among their leaves, but they knew better than to come down to where his brother and he were prowling. He could smell his brother, too, a familiar scent, strong and earthy, his scent as black as his coat. His brother was loping around the walls, full of fury. Round and round he went, night after night, tireless, searching, for prey, for a way out, for his mother, his litter mates, his pack, searching, searching, and never finding. Behind the trees, the walls rose, piles of dead manrock that loomed about this speck of living wood. Speckled grey they rose, and moss-spotted, yet thick and strong, and higher than any wolf could hope to leap. Cold iron and splintery wood closed off the only holes through the piled stones that hemmed them in. His brother would stop at every hole and bare his fangs in rage, but the ways stayed closed. He had done the same the first night and learned it was no good. Snarls would open no paths here. Circling the walls would not push them back. Lifting a leg and marking the trees would keep no men away. The world had tightened around them, but beyond the walled wood still stood the great grey caves of Manrock. Winterfell, he remembered. The sound coming to him suddenly. Beyond its sky-tall man-cliffs, the true world was calling, and he knew he must answer or die.
Brain. "I am looking for a maid of 3 and 10, she told the grey-haired goodwife beside the village well. "A high-born maid and very beautiful, with blue eyes and auburn hair. She may have been travelling with a portly knight of 40 years, or perhaps with a fool. Have you seen her?" "Not as I recall, sir," the goodwife said, knuckling her forehead. "But I'll keep my eye out, that I will." The blacksmith had not seen her either, nor the septon in the village sept, the swineherd with his pigs, the girl pulling up onions from her garden, nor any of the other simple folk that the maid of Tarth found amongst the daub and wattle huts of Rosby. Still, she persisted. "This is the shortest road to Duskendale," Brain told herself. "If Sansa came this way, someone must have seen her." At the castle gates, she posed her question to 2 spearmen, whose badges showed 3 red chevronels on ermine, the arms of House Rosby.
"If she's on the roads these days, she won't be no maid for long," said the older man. The younger wanted to know if the girl had that auburn hair between her legs as well. "I will find no help here." As Brain mounted up again, she glimpsed a skinny boy atop a piebald horse at the far end of the village. "I have not talked with that one," she thought, but he vanished behind the sept before she could seek him out. She did not trouble to chase after him. Most like, he knew no more than the others had. Rosby was scarce more than a wide place in the road. Sansa would have had no reason to linger here. Returning to the road, Brain headed north and east past apple orchards and fields of barley, and soon left the village and its castle well behind. It was at Duskendale that she would find her quarry, she told herself, if she came this way at all. "I will find the girl and keep her safe," Brain had promised Sir Jamie back at King's Landing, "for her lady mother's sake and for yours." Noble words, but words were easy. Deeds were hard. She had lingered too long and learned too little in the city. "I should have set out earlier, but to where?" Sansa Stark had vanished on the night King Joffrey died, and if anyone had seen her since, or had any inkling where she might have gone, they were not talking. Not to me, at least. Brain believed the girl had left the city. If she were still in King's Landing, the gold cloaks would have turned her up. She had to have gone elsewhere, but elsewhere is a big place. If I were a maiden newly flowered, alone and afraid, in desperate danger, what would I do? She had asked herself, where would I go? For her, the answer came easy. She would make her way back to Tarth, to her father. Sansa's father had been beheaded whilst she watched, however. Her lady mother was dead too, murdered at the Twins, and Winterfell, the great Stark stronghold, had been sacked and burned, its people put to the sword. She has no home to run to, no father, no mother, no brothers.
She might be in the next town or on a ship to Ashai. One seemed as likely as the other. Even if Sansa Stark had wanted to go home, how would she get there? The King's Road was not safe. Even a child would know that. The Ironborn held Moat Cailin athwart the neck, and at the twins sat the Freys, who had murdered Sansa's brother and Lady Mother. The girl could go by sea if she had the coin, but the harbour at King's Landing was still in ruins. The river, a jumble of broken quays and burned and sunken galleys. Braine had asked along the docks, but no one could remember a ship leaving on the night King Joffrey died. A few trading ships were anchoring in the bay and offloading by boat, one man told her, but more were continuing up the coast to Duskendale, where the port was busier than ever. Braine's mare was sweet to look upon and kept a pretty pace. There were more travellers than she would have thought. Begging brothers trundled by with their bowls dangling on thongs about their necks. A young septon galloped past upon a palfrey as fine as any lord's, and later she met a band of silent sisters who shook their heads when Braine put her question to them. A train of ox-carts lumbered south with grain and sacks of wool, and later she passed a swineherd driving pigs and an old woman in a horse litter with an escort of mounted guards. She asked all of them if they had seen a high-born girl of 13 years with blue eyes and auburn hair. None had. She asked about the road ahead as well. "Twixt here and Duskendale is safe enough," one man told her, "but past Duskendale there's outlaws and broken men in the woods." Only the soldier pines and sentinels still showed green. The broadleaf trees had donned mantles of russet and gold, or else uncloaked themselves to scratch against the sky with branches brown and bare. Every gust of wind drove swirling clouds of dead leaves across the rutted road. They made a rustling sound as they scuttled past the hooves of the big bay mare that Jaime Lannister had bestowed on her. As easy to find one leaf in the wind as one girl lost in Westeros. She found herself wondering whether Jaime had given her this task as some cruel jape. Perhaps Sansa Stark was dead, beheaded for her part in King Joffrey's death, buried in some unmarked grave. How better to conceal her murder than by sending some big, stupid wench from Tarth to find her? Jaime would not do that. He was sincere. He gave me the sword and called it Oathkeeper. Anyway, it made no matter. She had promised Lady Catelyn that she would bring back her daughters, and no promise was as solemn as one sworn to the dead. The younger girl was long dead, Jaime claimed. The Arya the Lannisters sent north to marry Roose Bolton's bastard was a fraud. That left only Sansa. Braine had to find her. Near dusk, she saw a campfire burning by a brook. Two men sat beside it grilling trout, their arms and armour stacked beneath a tree. One was old, and one was somewhat younger, though far from young. The younger rose to greet her. He had a big belly straining at the laces of his spotted doeskin jerkin. A shaggy, untrimmed beard covered his cheeks and chin, the colour of old gold. "We have trout enough for three, sir," he called out. It was not the first time Braine had been mistaken for a man. She pulled off her great helm, letting her hair spill free. It was yellow, the colour of dirty straw, and near as brittle. Long and thin, it blew about her shoulders.
"I thank you, sir."
The hedge knight squinted at her so earnestly that she realized he must be near-sighted.
"A lady, is it? Armed and armoured? Illy, gods be good, the size of her!" "I took her for a knight as well," the older knight said, turning the trout.
Had Braine been a man, she would have been called big. For a woman, she was huge. Freakish was the word she had heard all her life. She was broad in the shoulder and broader in the hips. Her legs were long, her arms thick. Her chest was more muscle than bosom. Her hands were big, her feet enormous. And she was ugly besides, with a freckled, horsey face and teeth that seemed almost too big for her mouth. She did not need to be reminded of any of that.
"Sirs," she said, "have you seen a maid of 3 and 10 upon the road?
She has blue eyes and auburn hair, and may have been in company with a portly red-faced man of 40 years. The near-sighted hedge knight scratched his head. I recall no such maid. What sort of hair is auburn?
Browny red, said the older man. No, we saw her not.
We saw her not, my lady, the younger told her. Come, dismount. The fish is almost done. Are you hungry?
She was, as it happened, but she was wary as well. Hedge knights had an unsavory reputation. A hedge knight and a robber knight are two sides of the same sword, it was said. These two do not look too dangerous. Might I know your name, sirs?
I have the honour to be Sir Creighton Longbow, of whom the singers sing, said the big-bellied one. You will have heard of my deeds on the Blackwater, mayhaps. My companion is Sir Illifer the Penniless. If there was a song about Creighton Longbow, it was not one Brian had heard. Their names meant no more to her than did their arms. Sir Creighton's green shield showed only a brown chief and a deep gouge made by some battle-axe. Sir Illifer bore gold and ermine gyrany, though everything about him suggested that painted gold and painted ermine were the only sorts he'd ever known. He was 60, if he was a day, his face pinched and narrow beneath the hood of a patched, rough-spun mantle. Mail-clad he went, but flecks of rust spotted the iron like freckles. Brian stood a head taller than either of them, and was better mounted and better armed in the bargain. If I fear the likes of these, I had as well swap my longsword for a pair of knitting needles.
I thank you, good sirs, she said. I will gladly share your trout. Swinging down, Brian unsaddled her mare and watered her before hobbling her to graze. She stacked her arms and shield and saddlebags beneath an elm. By then the trout was crisply done. Sir Creighton brought her a fish, and she sat cross-legged on the ground to eat it.
"We are bound for Duskendale, my lady," Longbow told her as he pulled apart his own trout with his fingers. "You would do well to ride with us. The roads are perilous."
Brian could have told him more about the perils of the roads than he might have cared to know. I thank you, sir, but I have no need of your protection.
I insist. A true knight must defend the gentler sex.
She touched her sword hilt. This will defend me, sir.
A sword is only as good as the man who wields it.
I wield it well enough.
As you will. It would not be courteous to argue with a lady. We will see you safe to Duskendale. Three together may ride more safely than one alone.
We were three when we set out from River Run, yet Jamie lost his hand, and Cleos Frey his life.
Your mounts could not keep up with mine.
Sir Creighton's brown gelding was an old sway-backed creature with rheumy eyes, and Sir Illifer's horse looked weedy and half-starved.
My steed served me well enough on the Blackwater, Sir Creighton insisted. Why, I did great carnage there and won a dozen ransoms.
Was my lady familiar with Sir Herbert Bowling? You shall never meet him now.
I slew him where he stood. When swords clash, you shall ne'er find Sir Creighton Longbow to the rear.
His companion gave a dry chuckle.
Cray, leave off. The likes of her has no need for the likes of us.
The likes of me. Brain was uncertain what he meant. Sir Illifer crooked a bony finger at her shield. Though its paint was cracked and peeling, the device it bore showed plain, a black bat on a field divided bendwise, silver and gold.
You bear a liar's shield to which you have no right. My grandfather's grandfather helped kill the last of Lothston. None since has dared to show that bat black as the deeds of them that bore it.
The shield was the one Sir Jamie had taken from the armoury at Harrenhall. Brian had found it in the stables with her mare, along with much else. Saddle and bridle, chainmail hauberk, and visored great helm, purses of gold and silver and a parchment more valuable than either. I lost mine own shield, she explained.
A true knight is the only shield a maiden needs, declared Sir Creighton stoutly.
Sir Illifer paid him no mind.
A barefoot man looks for a boot, a chilly man a cloak. But who would cloak themselves in shame? Lord Lucas bore that bat, the panda,
and Manfred of the Black Hood, his son? Why wear such arms, I ask myself, unless your own sin is fouler still and fresher? He unsheathed his dagger, an ugly piece of cheap iron. A woman freakish big and freakish strong, who hides her own true colours. Cray, behold the maid of Tarth, who opened Renly's royal throat for him. That is a lie. Renly Baratheon had been more than a king to her. She had loved him since first he came to Tarth on his leisurely lord's progress, to mark his coming of age. Her father welcomed him with a feast and commanded her to attend. Elsewise, she would have hidden in her room like some wounded beast. She had been no older than Sansa, more afraid of sniggers than of swords. "They will know about the rose," she told Lord Selwyn. "They will laugh at me." But the Even Star would not relent. And Renly Baratheon had shown her every courtesy, as if she were a proper maid and pretty. He even danced with her, and in his arms she'd felt graceful, and her feet had floated across the floor. Later, others begged a dance of her because of his example. From that day forth, she wanted only to be close to Lord Renly, to serve him and protect him. But in the end, she failed him. "Renly died in my arms, but I did not kill him," she thought. But these hedge knights would never understand. "I would have given my life for King Renly and died happy," she said. "I did no harm to him. I swear it by my sword." "A knight swears by his sword," Sir Creighton said. "Swear it by the Seven," urged Sir Illifer the Penniless. "By the Seven, then. I did no harm to King Renly. I swear it by Mother. May I never know her mercy if I lie. I swear it by the Father and ask that he might judge me justly. I swear it by the Maiden and Crone, by the Smith and the Warrior, and I swear it by the Stranger. May he take me now, if I am false." "She swears well for a maid," Sir Creighton allowed. "Aye," Sir Illifer the Penniless gave a shrug. "Well, if she's lied, the gods will sort her out." He slipped his dagger back away. "The first watch is yours." As the hedge knight slept, Brian paced restlessly around the little camp, listening to the crackle of the fire. "I should ride on whilst I can." She did not know these men, yet she could not bring herself to leave them undefended. Even in the black of night, there were riders on the road and noises in the woods that might or might not have been owls and prowling foxes. So Brian paced and kept her blade loose in its scabbard. Her watch was easy, all in all. It was after that was hard when Sir Illifer awoke and said he would relieve her. Brain spread a blanket on the ground and curled up to close her eyes. "I will not sleep," she told herself, bone-weary though she was. She had never slept easily in the presence of men. Even in Lord Renly's camps, the risk of rape was always there. It was a lesson she had learned beneath the walls of Highgarden, and again, when she and Jamie had fallen into the hands of the brave companions. The cold in the earth seeped through Brienne's blankets to soak into her bones. Before long, every muscle felt clenched and cramped from her jaw down to her toes. She wondered whether Sansa Stark was cold as well, wherever she might be. Lady Catelyn had said that Sansa was a gentle soul who loved lemon cakes, silken gowns, and songs of chivalry. Yet the girl had seen her father's head lopped off and been forced to marry one of his killers afterward. If half the tales were true, the dwarf was the cruelest Lannister of all. If she did poison King Joffrey, the imp surely forced her hand. She was alone and friendless at that court. In King's Landing, Brian had hunted down a certain Brella who had been one of Sansa's maids. The woman told her that there was little warmth between Sansa and the dwarf. Perhaps she had been fleeing him as well as Joffrey's murder. Whatever dreams Brain dreamed were gone when dawn awoke her. Her legs were stiff as wood from the cold ground, but no one had molested her, and her goods remained untouched. The hedge knights were up and about. Sir Illifer was cutting up a squirrel for breakfast while Sir Creighton stood facing a tree, having himself a good long piss. "Hedge knights,"
she thought, old and vain and plump and near-sighted, yet decent men for all that. It cheered her to know that there were still decent men in the world. They broke their fast on roast squirrel, acorn paste and pickles,